Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 242, with David Lowry. Apologies for my slightly croaky voice at the moment. I had the last of my club nights of the year last night. So late nights and a lot of talking really loud leaves you a little croaky. But it's weirdly fitting, because in this episode, David Lowry had pretty much completely lost his voice, but God bless him, he soldiered on, and we had a really good chat. This was the last podcast I recorded on a week where I had six podcasts in a week, and the other five were all people I kind of knew a bit, like I'd already met or already, I don't know, gigged with, done festivals with, done some acting work with or whatever else. So they were all ones I was more comfortable with, and I'm a big fan of David's work. I mean we'll hear about it all in the podcast. We really managed to fit a lot in a short amount of time. It's wicked. But yeah, so I was nervous about this one because he wasn't someone I'd met, a fan of his work, but you never know how that's going to be, if there's going to be clicks. It's similar, I guess, with last week's bonus episode with Matt Palmer, where it just ended up as an education in the film industry. It was just, we really clicked and just chatted about the ins and outs of it all. And yeah, it was a similar one here. I was kind of nervous. You never know how it's going to flow. Also, this was one that was part of a press junket, and they're always, you know, as the long-time listeners will know, sometimes these podcasts are scheduled for an hour and we go on for several. So it's always those nerves, a press junket, that time will be tight, or that you know, the guest could be exhausted from tons of podcasts. But David was a wicked, despite having every reason to be exhausted and unresponsive, because he literally had no voice. Poor dude. But yeah, we really hit it off. It was a great chat. Weirdly, the film I wanted to talk about the most was Peter a Dragon. Which is quite strange, because I love the ghost story. I like, you know, his new film, which as we speak now comes out next week. We talk about it that a lot, so we'll get all into all that in the podcast. Is there anything I should mention before we jump in? We've had the last club night of the year, so I don't need to plug that with you anymore. But obviously, speechdevelopmentrecords.com for all your Christmas needs. I've stocked up the signed section in there, so both of my books are in there signed. There's a limited number of Poetry in Emotion, which is my graphic novel of poetry, so there's only a few of them left, and this is the last batch we're going to have. There's a fair few of the Distraction Pieces podcast book left, and there's a load that are signed, and I've just had a load in, because again, we're on the last batch of that, because both of these we've sold out essentially of the publication, and all with proper publishers and that, like not a self-published or anything. So it's kind of mad that, yeah, we've gone through the whole print and reprint. It's nuts. So that's cool. But yeah, available signed at the speechdevelopmentrecords.com. There's my Edinburgh Fringe DVD that is available for digital download or on DVD. It's worth a look, man, over Christmas and that. It's an hour of poetry, I guess, but I made a point of making sure I was in a venue that had a bar and that it was engaging, and it didn't feel as if you come to watch a lecture. So it's worth a look over Christmas, maybe, if you get a chance. What else do I need to tell you? Obviously, patreon.com/scroobiouspip. It's going mad over there. I love how people are just, we've built our own little community that doesn't have all the negative trappings of a wider social media. I mean, speaking of social media, I recommend following David Lowry on Instagram. He's cool with the way he does stuff. He posts really just interesting stuff about his films, about film locations, and also he Instagram stories a lot of films he's gone to see, and when he has film movie marathons at home. And you all know I'm a massive film nerd, so this just has had me buzzed, and I in fact we've chatted a bit since the podcast, and I hit him up about a film called The Square, which is going to be in my Films of the Year. I'm doing, as ever, I'll be doing a Films of the Year podcast. I think it'll be dropping in January. It'll be the first one after the Drunk Cast over Christmas. So, yeah, I hit him up about The Square because it's one that has blown me away this year, but I've not seen many people talk about. And the dude absolutely schooled me because he had seen it and recommended Force Majeure, which is by the same director. It was the film we did before that. And I watched that the other week and it blew me away because it's this dude. Hang on, let me remember his name. I'm reaching over to my Blu-ray. Yes, I buy things still. I like to have a physical copy. Ruben Östlund. He's got a really good way. And it's weird because in The Square he does it, but then there's also these two moments for me that are different from that. But he's got a really weird way of kind of, like, you know, everyone said that Seinfeld was the TV show where nothing happens. He gets a lot from scenes, just letting them play out slowly and naturally. And not this, like, there's tons of genuine tight humour and things like that, but not the kind of really tight scripted dialogue that we've become accustomed to in film. And that's become the norm in film, I guess. There's a far more natural flow to it. And I guess that happens a lot in dramas, but not so much in comedies. I'm rambling on for ages now, but in kind of realist comedies, it doesn't happen so much. In kind of character stuff and things like that, they'll often improvise a lot, but it feels like it doesn't happen so much in these more deadpan type things. So I really like his style for that because it feels really natural. And you kind of, it sounds weird to say, but I found on both of them, I'm kind of smirking and amused constantly, but couldn't tell you any like strict laugh out loud type moments. It's kind of, and they're always quite weird and they're making a comment on a lot of different things. Anyway, I recommend the dude, but I'll be having my Films of the Year podcast at the end of the year. So you'll be excited to tune in for that, I'm sure, to hear what else has made the list. Because The Square is one of the ones that has made the list. There's a few that I'm certain aren't going to be knocked off. Obviously I'm busy a lot, but often if I'm busy and I'm on the road, I'll catch a film of the evening because I'm not that sociable a person. I'm not a partier. I don't drink much. I'd rather go and see a film on my own. So I watched a lot of films in the first 2/3 of the year, and then I've had this period where I've had a lot of other things on that I've caught a decent amount still, but not as many as I'd like. So at the moment, I'm really on a cinema binge. Every time I'm in London for a screening for future podcasts and stuff like that, I'm normally catching a couple of films before the screening. So I'm going in for two warm-ups and then on to the main course. So yeah, trust me, I'm doing my due diligence to tell you the very best films of the year, in my humblest of opinions. Anyway, I've rambled on more than enough. You're going to really enjoy this podcast. Apologies if the slightly raspy voice is uncomfortable listening for you. I think the apology might be that it's maybe too erotic for you to enjoy, because it's a sexy, raspy voice. And then apologies for forcing David to chat to me for 40 minutes with clearly no voice. But yeah, I think you're going to enjoy this. I'll be back at the end to tell you what's to come. I'll tell you now that next week I've got Boots Riley on, who's got another film, who's also got a film that might be in my films of the year. We shall see. But yeah, that's a great chat. So I'll tell you more of what's to come after this. Let's get into episode 242 of the Distraction Pieces podcast with David Lowry. As far as I can tell, it's really good. I've started in the traditional podcast manner. I've started recording as we're going.
I love it.
I'm joined today by David Lowry, and you're struggling a little bit with your voice, right?
Yeah, I've got a rare case of laryngitis, so I might just let my timbre slip down a little bit and get a little raspy here.
It's fine.
Own it.
And initially, it makes it sound as if the audio is glitching out slightly, so it's absolutely, they will assume it's an error on their end or a problem with their phone.
Or they just assume I'm doing my Tom Waits impression.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, I'm lucky that we've got 45 minutes here. So I want to talk about a load of things. But obviously we're going to start with talking about The Old Man and the Gun. And it's a tough one because your voice issues are making it even more prevalent. That I kind of finished watching this and thought, a lot of me doesn't want to talk about this film because I don't think there's much more. There's not much more perfect or not much more that can be added to the fact that it's a heist movie and the crew is Robert Redford, Danny Glover and Tom Waits.
It's like ticket
That's
sold.
Kind of the best advert ever, yeah. Right? As soon as, and again, on a lot of these films, it's always a bit scary if I've got a podcast already booked in, but in general, I'll try not to watch a trailer beforehand or anything beforehand. Again, I'm a fan of your work previously, so I was ready to have the podcast regardless. I knew I'd enjoy it in some way, but I loved going into it kind of blind. And I mean, it's a hell of a story. Just speaking of Tom Waits and Danny Glover and Robert Redford, did you have those guys in mind all along as you were writing it? Because the characters seem so perfect there.
Well, Robert Redford brought the project to me, so this movie would not exist without him.
Because it's a true story.
It's a true story it's based on a New Yorker article about the real Forrest Tucker.
Yeah.
And he'd been wanting to play this part for a long time.
Wow.
And he saw something in my work that he liked, and he brought the story to me. And here we are a couple of years later having made this movie, and it's a real treat to have gotten to work with him. A real honor, in fact.
Yeah.
But it was definitely written for him. Like, I would not have made this movie without him.
Yeah.
With Tom and Danny, I just was thinking, which great actors, which great characters in film history would I want to see hanging out with Robert Redford? Because they spend most of the time just hanging out. You don't see them like robbing that many banks. You just see them hanging out.
Well, that was exactly it. It was the fact that there's loads of just little interactions and stories told that I'm like, that story couldn't have been written without Tom Waits in mind or without
Precisely.
Danny Glover. It's like, this has to have, this isn't that he's playing this role. It's like, you found your person.
Exactly. So those characters that they play in real life, the Over the Hill gang was like 20 or 30 guys. It was like a lot of hardened criminals.
Yeah.
In fabricating the story, I reduced it to two guys and just wanted to find two actors who could hold their own against Bob, who brought their own sort of legacy with them on their shoulders, and who I just wanted to hang out with.
Yeah.
And I wanted to wait until I cast those parts to really write them. So in the script, there was not much to those characters. Teddy Green and John Waller were barely there.
Yeah.
There were many scenes where it was just the guys count their money. You know, that was the content of the scene.
Yeah.
And I knew that it would get filled out later on. So I had always admired Danny.
Yeah.
I loved him as an actor. I love what he does as a producer. He puts money into really challenging, adventurous international cinema. And I just wanted to talk to him about that, among other things. So we sent the script to him, and he really liked it and was excited to do it. I think he was really wanted to be part of, you know, Bob's crew.
Yeah.
And then Tom is someone I discovered at an early age through Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Yeah.
That was like one of my favorite movies growing up. And he plays Renfield in that film, and I was like, who's this crazy guy? He's amazing. And I remember getting the making of book, like the book about how they made the film, and I read about Tom Waits and discover that he's a musician. I'm like 10 years old at this point.
Amazing.
And they talk about how he serenaded Winona Ryder on set with Waltzing Matilda on her birthday.
Wow.
And then I discover him playing Waltzing Matilda. You know, I discovered on the records and discover him as a musician, and he just blows my mind. He's just someone who, like, I'm like, who is this guy? It's just so incredible. So he's been a part of my life for so long. I've been such a fan of his. And of course, from that role and his music, you then discover him in the Jim Jarmusch films.
Yeah.
And then later on working with Terry Gilliam, you see him pop up in movies and with Coppola and Rumblefish.
Yeah.
As well as Dracula and the soundtrack for One from the Heart. So I didn't think he would actually do the movie.
Yeah.
I didn't think that I had a shot in hell in actually working with him, but I just wanted to talk to him.
Yeah.
So we sent it to him, and I was like, there's not much on the page, but if Tom likes this, like, I'll get on the phone with him and we can figure out where we can take it from there.
Yeah.
And that's what happened. He liked it. It turns out that he had seen Ain't Them Body Saints and liked that. And he didn't want to do the movie, but he wanted to talk about it.
Yeah.
So we get on the phone.
I love that.
He's like, I don't think I'm going to do this movie, but let's just talk.
Yeah.
And so we just talked. Over the course of that conversation, he told me several things which wound up in the script. Mm. He said, you know, he was thinking about going on tour, and he's like, I'm 67 years old. I got to figure out what my next score is going to be. And I was like, that's going in the script.
Yeah.
And we ended that first conversation, you know, with him turning down the film.
Yeah.
But he left the door open. He was like, you know, I don't think I'm going to do it, but if you want to keep talking about it, let's keep talking about it.
Yeah.
And so we did. And a few phone calls later, his mind had miraculously changed and he wanted to do it. And he had so many wonderful ideas. Like, he wanted his hair to be white. He wanted to look like Lee Marvin. He wanted to have a Jesus tattoo on his neck.
Yeah.
And he wanted to tell a story. And I asked him what story he had in mind. And he told me the story. I don't want to spoil it for people, but there's a story he tells in the film that is a 100% autobiographical story from the life of Tom Waits. And it was just one of those things, like, beautiful. The movie is better for that.
Yeah.
There's no point to that as far as the plot is related. It doesn't affect the story of the film, but the movie would be lesser if it didn't have that story in it.
Completely. And again, I think there's such an important gem there in the even if it's a project you don't want to do, is taking that phone call and talking about it. And it's particularly in our digital age, it's so easy to send an email and say, no,
yeah,
good.
Completely.
And I had an experience like that that genuinely changed my life, that when I was doing music, a writer called Kelly Marcel, who at the time I'd never heard of, but I'm now big friends with, emailed me saying, I'd love to have you in a film, this, I want to do a musical. And my initial reaction was, no, I'm really busy, I'm touring. And then I said, well, let's just meet. And I met, and through her, I met Tom Hardy and Paddy Considine, and these actors who have been my inspiration from day one. And that led to everything. Whereas that could have been an easy, because the fact is, at that point, I was too busy.
Right.
So it wasn't going to happen. So that could have been such an easy no. But doing that kind of, well, let's sit face to face and I'll tell you no.
I'll
tell you no to yourself.
Yeah.
To you. And it makes all the difference. It
makes a huge difference.
So how was that, though, having a Robert Redford select you? Because your body of work is so varied. It's kind of, it made me think of, obviously you've worked with Casey Affleck a lot, and it made me think of one of Ben Affleck's lines in Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back, which I made note of what have I been telling you? You got to do the safe picture and then you do the art house picture. And again, it kind of, it feels like your career with doing like a following up Ain't the Body Saints with a Disney film.
That's hilarious.
It's mind-blowing.
There's that scene in Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back where, like, Wes Craven is shooting Good Will Hunting 2 hunting season.
Yeah.
And he's just counting his money off to the side.
Yeah.
That's always been, like, a warning sign to me.
But that's it. It's been beautiful that you've got that variation, but without the... I mean, they joke about it in there, but I'm sure Ben will concede that there's been films he's done that have been, as you said, for the money. Whereas you've managed to get the variation and still make them artistic. Again, Pete's Dragon is one of the films I want to talk about the most because... I love it. It's just wonderful. So
it was one of those situations where I didn't think they would ever hire me.
Yeah.
So I just went in and pitched a version of the story that I would really literally want to make.
Yeah.
That really mattered to me. And they're like, great, sounds good. You should write that. And so...
That's so mad, particularly with what we know of the how to put it delicately, the cautiousness of Disney, as we've seen with James Gunn and things like this.
Certainly.
Going from a film that's very... It walks a line. It's sexually aggressive. It's aggressive. There's some dark shades,
edginess
there.
To it. Yeah.
Yeah. So to then go, have this. I mean, obviously, it might help that every great Disney film starts with the death of parents.
Of course,
I don't know what their obsession is.
Yes,
there.
Exactly.
It's the darkest obsession that we seem to ignore. But The Lion King.
They all have
everything. Just you go through the lot. Bambi. Everything.
It's like a narrative trope that you just have to, you know, sign on the dotted line. You're going to kill some parents when you make a Disney
movie. I will kill some parents, but I won't do any naughty tweets.
Yeah. It's really, everyone at Disney they love movies.
Yeah.
They have great taste in movies. And Sean Bailey, who runs a studio, is on the board at Sundance. So he goes to Sundance every year and sees all of the new voices that are there. So he saw Ain't Them Body Saints. But the weird thing was that we were already working on Pete's Dragon before Ain't the Body Saints even premiered at Sundance.
Oh, wow.
There was a short film I made called Pioneer.
Yeah.
And the script for Ain't the Body Saints was out there. So people kind of like were aware of it as a script that was being made. So the producers of Pete's Dragon, the ones who were had the property, they came to me and asked if I had a take on it. And I was like, sure, you guys are never going to hire me. So here's what I would do. They were like, just don't think about the original film. Just use the title as a jumping off point and bring us something original. So I came up with a story with my partner, Toby Hobrooks, and we pitched it to them and they liked it. And then they saw Anthem Body Saints and luckily weren't scared away.
They didn't get put off.
Yeah, exactly. And then they hired us to write it. And I think that they liked the fact that I wanted to do it. They liked the fact that after making this edgy, adult, romantic drama, I wanted to make a children's film and bring to it that same emotional veracity.
Yeah.
They wanted to know that I cared about it.
Yeah.
And they could tell that from my work that I make movies that I care about, that I'm not going to just go in there and phone it in. And every step of the way, I was always like, are you sure you want me to make this movie? Are you sure you want the version that I will make? Because let me explain what this movie will feel like. Let me explain what it'll look like.
Yeah.
It'll be a Disney movie, but it'll be a certain type of Disney movie.
Yeah.
And they were on board every step of the way. I just kept waiting for the other shoe to drop, and it never did. They wanted my version of Pete's Dragon.
It sits in there. I mean, just weirdly of mentioning Kelly Marcel there, it sits in there with Saving Mr. Banks, where it's a Disney film, but it's heartbreaking. It's got that human element. And I needed to ask as well with that, did you grow up with dogs? Have you got dogs? Because Elliot is just a big, stupid dog. He is a dragon, but it's just the thing that instantly... It caught me off guard at the start. I was like, oh, this isn't how I know dragons to be. It's like, this is... And I love just the details of just him struggling to land at points and stuff like that. Just being this big... Having all the intention, but still just being this innocent, floppy creature.
No, I grew up with dogs, and now I have cats, and I'm a crazy cat person.
Yeah.
And my wife and I are thinking of getting a dog now, because like, we're both like... At that point in our lives, we're like, yeah, we should have a dog.
Yeah, yeah.
We should have a dog again.
Dog time.
And hopefully our cats won't hate us for it.
Yeah.
We've fostered cats. My wife and I are both we've been vegan for decades at this point. And so we're very into animals.
Yeah.
And I wanted my love of animals to come through in that character. I wanted him to feel like a pet, you know, like the pet that you want to snuggle up with that will comfort you. And to really lean on that affection that humans and animals can have for one another. One of the great joys of developing that character was learning that the animators would not only film their own pets for reference, but spend a lot of time just watching funny animal videos on YouTube.
Amazing. So that's work.
And
that's beautiful.
What an amazing way to spend the day. Just like looking at animal behavior on YouTube.
Yeah.
So that crash landing, I can look at the movie now and just tell you what individual scenes were based on. The crash landing was this seagull that just couldn't quite stick his landing.
Amazing.
When he rolls over in his cave, that's my cat rolling over. I could show you a video of that happening right now. He does that all the time. And obviously, like when he like shakes himself off when he's running through the water, that's definitely our visual effects supervisor Eric's dog doing that.
And I love it.
There's so much personal detail in that animation that everyone is pouring their own affection for their own pets into the performance, and it comes through. I mean, you just see all the animators loved that character because he was all of their pets.
And that's the key to great cinema, right? Is finding these stories that might be fanciful or unimaginable, and then you as a writer or director finding the bits of you in there, the actors again. I think it's only since I've started going into acting and reading tons of books on it and nerding out. I'm an obsessive kind of guy. I'm a film fan anyway, but in this area, it's realizing that it's not, you know, transformation is great, but what gets that transformation across is finding what's you in there, the you in that character.
Completely.
To make it real, to make it human, rather than just I'm being over the top and I've transformed into this person. So that must be great to get that with the people you're working with everyone, to bring a film to life.
It completely is. I mean, that's one of the things I always look for when I start writing it, is like, how can I make this autobiographical?
Yeah.
And it never needs to be literally autobiographical, but I need to find that thing that makes it connect to me.
Yeah.
And I always encourage everyone I'm working with to do the same. I want everyone to find the ways in which our mutual efforts will resound within our own lives, and that we can draw from our own lives to to create something together. Like that's something that's really important to me.
Yeah, it's something I encountered a lot in my music career. Was I'd have people ask me, like, because it was kind of spoken word and hip hop, and it was all quite often quite dark and personal. And people would ask how you find the courage to be so personal. I'd have to admit, it's like it's all fiction. It's drawing from true experiences, but then writing fiction, and then that allows people to go, wow.
They assume.
You've opened your heart there.
Exactly. They
gives
feel
you comfort
that.
To open your heart as well, I guess.
Because you're, because it's not 100, it's not completely literal.
Yeah.
So you feel like you're not exposing yourself to the world.
Yeah.
And yet at the same time, you are giving the world a very clear version of your own heart
yeah.
and of your truth
yeah.
and what it is that compels you to do what you do.
Completely. So to get back to Old Man and Gun, how was it to be part of that with Robert Redford? Did you know at the time, because he said now that this is his swan song, and it could not be a more perfect swan song. I was watching it the whole time thinking, no one else could play that role. I'm a big fan of Robert Redford. I don't think he's had any role he's played better. You know, there's probably some that are on a par. It's hard to say when I've only just seen it. It's hard to put it in the realms of history, but it's perfect because it's a character that for the audience to go along with it relies 100% on charm.
Mm-hmm.
Because the fact is, again, we've not really said what it is. It's an older man who's robbed banks his whole life and escaped from prison, and he's got a gang of older men. And the fact is that he's a criminal, and you know, there's probably people getting scared. There's all these other things, but
he hurts people's feelings left and right in this movie.
But he's played as and written as the word that came to mind was a rascal.
Yes.
It's
the charming
naughty, cheeky boy.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, he happens to be robbing banks and doing these dark things, but it's lovable all the way. And his interaction with Sissy Spacek is just, it's just the most warm, and again, all of it, it's another thing, it just, none of it feels written. It all feels like, obviously knowing how films work, it has to be, but it feels like you've gone, right, we'll get up one morning and let's start making this story, because it feels so natural and human.
From the very beginning, Bob wanted it to be a spiritual successor to some of his earlier, you know, the movies that made him famous.
Yeah.
Where he played an actual outlaw.
Yeah.
So that
was
always...
lines referencing that. I'm not going to ruin it because it's so good to watch in there.
Yeah, totally.
A line or two in there that you're like, oh, this is... Yeah.
And so that was always on my mind. So I always knew that... I always knew that it would be a bookend of sorts. That we were, you know, kind of providing the follow-up to Butch Cassidy that Butch Cassidy never had.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was on my mind, but I never thought of it as his last movie or like a swan song until a few months before we started shooting, he did an interview in which he said he was going to retire after we wrapped Principal Photography.
Wow. Yeah.
And that just sort of like landed on me all of a sudden. My phone lit up and people were like, did you know about this? And I was like, no, I had no idea. We'd never talked about it.
The pressure then.
And so suddenly I had this pressure
that
I might be making the final Robert Redford movie. And after a few days of stressing about that, I just thought, I'm not going to think about that at all. I just had to cast it out of my mind, because otherwise it would infect everything we did with a sense of finality. And one of the beautiful things about this movie is that in spite of feeling like a bookend, it also is got a lot of a youthful spirit to it.
Yeah.
I really wanted Bob and Sissy to play their parts as if they were teenagers. I didn't want them to be commenting on how old they are or how much time they've got left or being too, you know, wistful and reminiscent about the good old days. I wanted them to be looking to the future.
Yeah.
And
it's played like a teenage romance.
Exactly. Exactly. They are the age they are. There's no getting around that. So we don't need to talk about it.
Yeah.
Had I gone into this movie thinking every day, this is Robert Redford's last movie, I would have shot it that way.
Yeah.
Every time he picks up the phone, I'd be like, this is the last time we're going to shoot Robert Redford at a payphone in a movie.
Yeah.
And that would have been heavy.
Yeah.
We wanted the movie to be light on its feet. So we just never thought about it. By the time we'd finished shooting it, I'd forgotten that he'd said it.
Yeah.
And then a few weeks before we started doing press for the movie, he started talking about it again. And then, you know, it works its way out into the press and becomes part of the story of the film. And at that point, the weight of that hit me. And looking at the movie in those final weeks of, you know, I guess it was like July and August as we were starting to ramp up to do press and we were doing a couple long lead interviews and he would mention it, I started to look at the movie with that in mind, yeah. and it became more emotional. Yeah. It went from being a very rollicking, fun-loving, high-spirited romp to being something that really did feel like a swan song. And I'm glad that that's coming to the movie now, that we didn't bake that into it.
Yeah, completely.
From the get-go, because it's a nice note for the movie to have, but we're not overdoing it.
I couldn't agree more, and it's something I hadn't realized was missing from it. And for better, there's been loads of films that are the older guys on the road again,
yeah.
Vegas or whatever
yep,
else.
Yep.
And this, again, it's never addressed that they're old, other than in the fact that that's in the description
yes.
of the person who's robbing the bank, all that. It's never played as, oh, it's these old boys.
No.
It's just, yeah, it's some lads, it's some
like,
mates.
It's so refreshing to not talk about that. And that was something we never, I've
even
never
though
sat,
it's key to the story,
it's key to the story.
It's hugely bold to ignore it. Essentially, the main point is kind of ignored.
You just get it. It's just you see them. You see that when Bob walks across the room, he's got a little hitch in his gait now because he's the age he is. You don't have to have him complaining about it.
Yeah.
It's just part of who he is now, and it's all the acknowledgement is there on screen.
Yeah, it's a fascinating one because it's one of the first films that I feel. The prior knowledge of the actors informs something of the characters.
Oh,
I've been kind of thinking a lot recently that a lot of my favourites, or a lot of the biggest TV shows, I think one of the reasons they're so good is that they often have unknown actors in. So Game of Thrones and so many other things, it was their first gig. So you only know them as that character. And there is something that's taken away when, you know, Al Pacino... If you're casting Al Pacino, it's because you want Al Pacino. So it's kind of there's a weight there that takes it out of the story you're losing yourself in. And this is a rare time where it adds to it because it's completely right. Your knowledge of how old they are or the awareness of their years is that you know them from things from years ago. You know a Lethal Weapon.
Yes.
You know Tom Waits from, as said, Dead Man, all the Jim Jarmusch stuff, and just his music.
Yeah.
So it doesn't need to be said. It's kind of, yeah, well, here, it's these older guys, remember?
I love leaning into the legacy of these guys, of all of these actors, and leaning into their history. And rather than, like, casting them in parts where they had to set those past incarnations of themselves aside, I was like, let's embrace it. You know, with Tom... Maybe you're the older version of your character from Down by Law.
Yeah.
You know,
even though they're
different eras that the movies are set in, like, let's embrace that. Let's let this build on that. And with Redford, certainly, I was like, we're never for a moment going to forget, you know, who you are when we're watching this movie.
Yeah.
So rather than, like, go overboard trying to make you into a character that you'll never completely be anyway, let's just embrace the Robert Redford of it all.
Yeah.
And let that do a lot of our heavy lifting.
Yeah, I love that. It also made me think at points of Harvey, which is my favourite film of all time, Jimmy Stewart.
Yeah.
And it's one that I feel has always been needing a remake because it feels so prevalent today with overdiagnosis of stuff and things like that. But the thing that it struck me with this was, and again, it's not giving away too much, but when Robert Redford is committing these robberies... The defining feature is he's happy.
Yes.
And there's a brief moment in the film where he's not, and he's sad. He's a different man. He's a changed man. And then you start to look at, well, and again, this is a weird justification. It's like, well, these banks are insured. They've got coverage. No one's actually being hurt.
It's a really slippery slope.
It's a slippery slope. But it is that kind of no one, all the people have, in this version of the story, all the people who've been robbed are saying, yeah, he kind of seemed... Like, they don't seem scarred by it. So it's one of them where you're like, well, he's just happy that way. And Harvey essentially is about a guy who's mentally ill in some way. But when they start to fix him, he's miserable.
He loses
something. Well, just let him be who he is.
Yeah.
Let him be delusional or whatever else. Just allow that. It doesn't need fixing if it's not doing anyone any harm.
Exactly.
And it felt like elements of that in this story, you know?
It's a culturally grey area to play with because I cannot condone what he does.
Of course, of course.
But... I admire it. And I also, I mean, the reason, again, not to spoil anything, but the reason why, you know, the cop in the movie does what he does is because I didn't want to see Forrest Tucker get caught.
It would have been
sad to me. It would have been disappointing.
Yeah, completely.
And he should have been caught. Yes, his daughter is right when she says he needs to be locked up. But at the same time, does he? Yeah. I mean, I really, like, I don't want to see him get caught.
Yeah, yeah, particularly at that point in his life and all of this kind of thing.
Yeah, it's like, what's the worst that could happen?
Yeah, exactly. So, before we move on from this film, what is it about heist movies that is just exciting and engaging? And American Animals came out this year. And it was another movie that I really liked because it was a heist movie that was essentially, there is money involved, but it was essentially based around the reason for doing the heist is because it seems like an exciting thing to do. And that's the vibe of Redford's character in this, is that he just enjoys it. In fact, he states that at different points. He's like, it's fun.
There's like two things. Yeah. One is that on a cultural level, we like seeing an individual go up against an institution.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so when you see someone rob a bank, that is the embodiment of, especially in America, I feel like, where the entire country came from, you know, a group of individuals going up against a massive institution, which is where we are now. Going up against the throne. And it's so prevalent in the U.S., that sense of like that outlaw mentality. And that's why you see kids with Scarface posters on their wall.
Yeah, of course.
We should not, you know, put Tony Montana on a pedestal, but we do because he's an outlaw who is one guy going up against something.
Yeah.
And so there's something very appealing about that. The other thing is there's so much pleasure to be had in watching professionals execute a plan with proficiency.
Yeah.
When you see people who know what they're doing, planning something and then executing that plan, it is just delightful and delicious and exciting and thrilling. And then, of course, sometimes those plans go wrong, and that is when it gets suspenseful and tragic and breathtaking. But there's so much satisfaction to be had in watching people who are good at what they do doing something that they love doing.
Yeah.
And the heist film gives us all of that. So I think that's why it's been one of the, you know, the great genres in cinema, is because you're getting to participate in all of those things at once.
How much restraint did it take to not go too deep into the actual act of the heist? Again, it's a heist movie that's not about the heist. We've got films like Rafifi that have nailed the heist scene and things like that. And that can often be the almost a distracting factor, because you're like, oh, how can we do this different? How can we do this?
And exactly.
This film, it's a heist movie, but the heist is a tiny part of it. It's the relationships, the characters, and the outlook.
It wasn't that hard, because I'd write these heist sequences. I'd write these big bank robbery sequences, and then I'd go look at something like Rafifi and be like, oh man, it's better. Like, I can't top that. So rather than trying to top it, I was like, let's just sidestep it. Let's just take the 20 minutes that we would have spent on a big heist set piece and focus on something else, and let that be what gives this movie its distinct character.
Yeah, yeah. And I think one of the things I love about your approach to writing and directing, it's an interesting one, because, and not to turn this into a psychiatrist couch thing, but it feels like, because you started so young, you directed your first film at like 19, right? Or
I mean, technically even younger, but that was like my first attempt at making a feature was when I was 19.
And then there was a lot of shorts in between. Yeah. And then, again, I had assumed Ain't Them Body Saints was your debut. It wasn't until I looked back, I was like, all right, you've been doing this a long time. But it feels like it gives you a confidence and comfort in what you're doing. And I mean, we spoke of the cop in Old Man and the Gun is Casey Affleck. He's also he's been in
a couple of them,
a few of them, but he's also in Ghost Story. And Ghost Story was one that it blew me away. Number one, just artistically, I enjoyed it as a film. But number two, as someone who writes scripts and stuff as well, to have the confidence, I mean, you must have turned in like a 20-page script for that feature, because there's so much that's just a really simple, easy one to say. She eats the pie.
That literally is it.
And then it's a 10-minute scene or something like that.
The ghost walks through the house.
Exactly. You know, it's like that must have been such a. And again, I'm referencing for some reason Kelly Marcel a lot, but when I was asking her advice on writing scripts, she was like, read good scripts. Don't go and read the books that tell you how to write scripts, because they'll restrict you. And, you know, it's good to learn these things, but they'll restrict you. Read scripts that you like and then just write. And it feels like that kind of confidence is in your approach, because, that's a short script on paper.
It was about 30 pages.
Yeah.
And the movie's not that different from the script. It's not like it changed a lot.
Yeah.
It was all pretty much there on paper, but there wasn't that much there.
Yeah.
It was definitely the scariest movie I've ever made. Like, I felt like I was jumping off a cliff every single day because we just, it's so high concept. Yeah. The idea that we're going to follow this guy in a bedsheet for 90 minutes and become emotionally connected to his journey, it could have gone horribly awry.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
there were versions of it that we shot that did not work. And yeah, so every day it was just like, everyone was on set working so hard to make this thing work and it might fail miserably. And I was just terrified. But yeah, I did have like this confidence that there was at the core of this idea something worth pursuing. And we just had to keep going until we made it work. And yeah, that's what we did. It's something that I don't know if I could have made that movie 10 years ago. I probably I couldn't have.
Yeah.
It would have been a different movie anyway. I'm not who I was 10 years ago. It definitely came at the right point in my life, having just made Pete's Dragon, getting ready to make Old Man the Gun. Jumping into that was a cleansing experience because I really got to trust myself as a filmmaker. When I talk about writing screenplays, I really think of writing them. I don't think about them as a writer. I think about them as a director.
Yeah.
And writing them is the first step in directing.
Yeah.
I'm directing on paper.
Yeah, yeah.
And with that one, it really, I didn't give myself that much paper to work with before I was on set making the film. And so it really was a process of figuring out what the movie was while we were making it.
Yeah.
We did have a script to go on, but like you said,
it's not a lot.
If you have a scene where it just says Rooney Mara eats a pie, it could be shot a number of different ways.
Yeah.
And figuring out the right way for the movie that I wanted to make was a challenge.
And from a production, a line producer point of view, things like, it must have been tough because, like, well, how long do they need for this?
Yes,
this
exactly. One sentence? Yeah, yeah.
Is this the whole of today or is this the first 10 minutes of today?
It would change. Right. Like, there were days where I was like, you know that thing we were going to shoot today? We're not shooting it anymore. We're going to focus on this instead because it's more important.
So was working with Casey key in that one? I mean, number one, I need to ask, was he always under the sheet or is that, or would you rather not?
Well, I don't think it changes the movie to say that he wasn't always under it.
Mm.
In figuring out what the movie was, we had to do a lot of reshooting.
Yeah.
So we shot him under the sheet for a big chunk of it. And then we stopped production to kind of edit.
And
figure out like what else we needed.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's safe to say at this point that the house gets knocked down.
Yeah.
And we're like, let's save that. Let's not shoot that until we have the rest of the movie cut together.
Wow.
In case we need to go back and shoot more.
Yeah.
And it turned out that we did. And
that's fascinating.
And so the stuff that we went back and shot, he wasn't available because he was doing the Manchester by the Sea promotional tour at that point. And our art director, who had helped put the sheet together and knew it very well, he was the same height and build as Casey, and he stepped up. And so he's credited in the movie as Ghost Stage 2, because at Stage 2 of the production, he took over.
Amazing.
And you can't tell. Like,
there's
times where it's like, it's Casey, and then the reverse shot is David Pink wearing the sheet, and you can't tell. But it was necessary for us to sort of figure out the language of how that ghost worked, and it just took time, and part of that time involved reshoots. But it was necessary to have him there at the beginning so that we attach ourselves to him as an actor that we recognize, as a character that we can empathize with, so that when that transition occurs, when, you know, the sheet gets put over his face and then he sits up, we accept him as a character rather than just a symbol.
Yeah, yeah. And that made a huge difference. And it feels like it felt like the perfect actor to work on a project. I like this because I'm sure he did a film with Gus Van Sant in a desert. Yeah, Jerry. That again, it's like
one of my favorite movies.
I'd say that's two sheets of a script. It's literally like, and again, it blew me away because it felt similar to the way I use it as an example on these things. But if you're watching a film with subtitles, 10 minutes in, you forget you're reading.
Yes.
It just becomes a natural thing.
And when
thing.
You think about the film later, you think about it in your own language.
And that was it with Jerry. You're like, there's barely any dialogue, yet a few minutes in, you're just like, oh, this is how films work.
Yep.
And it goes, and it's similar with a ghost story. It's like, oh, this is
The interaction. I mean, Jerry was a big deal to me.
Yeah.
Like, that movie really, it opened my eyes to a lot of cinema that I hadn't been aware of, like Gus Van Sant's influences on that movie, like Bellatar, I had not seen yet, but that was a gateway for me.
Yeah.
And it also was the movie that really made me excited about Casey. And, you know, I wanted to work with, I was a fan of him, of his, you know, he's in all the Kevin Smith movies and he's in To Die For. And I'd been aware of him, but That was the movie that made me a fan of his.
Mumbling away in Good Will Hunting.
Exactly. Yes. Just exactly. Just in, yeah.
incomprehensibly. Yes. Just like, yeah. So I mean, you spoke about a reshoots, and that makes perfect sense, because if ever there was a film that was gonna that you were gonna know what you'd got in the edit, it's that, a ghost yeah. story, and particularly I'd say even the score, a film with such little dialogue, the score is telling so much of the story. So how was that to kind of to wrap principal photography? And know you're probably about a quarter of a way through essentially directing the film, because there's so much still to direct.
It was scary. It was like, as fun as it was to make the movie, it was really hard.
Yeah.
You know, it was really a challenge. And to wrap the first chunk of it and think, like, we're not done yet. We're all coming back. We're all coming back to this house and we're going to keep shooting. It was daunting. And I remember showing the first assembly to Daniel Hart, my composer, and I was like, what do you think? Like, what do you think? What do you make of this?
Yeah.
And he's like, I don't know yet. it was a lot of head scratching early on as we just tried to figure out what the movie was. And it's surprising to me to look at the script, and it's not that different. You know, the movie is the script. It was all there on the page, but we went on a lot of tangents. We took a lot of detours, and we just had to figure out what that script looked like when it was brought to life.
Yeah.
And it was a really invasive creative process. We're like, here's what's on the page. Here's what we're seeing. How do we reconcile these two things? What is it that we actually are looking for when we have this one line in the script that says the ghost walks through the house? What was I thinking when I wrote that? What does the emotional quality need to be? So as things settled down, as they always do, and we kept shooting and as the film defined itself for us, I think I got an idea of where the music needed to be in the movie and sort of what the quality needed to be. But one of the great things about working with Daniel is he scored all of my movies.
Right. I was going to ask that, because it seems like such a key relationship in your works, because it is the real... I feel each film feels so different, but it's partly because of the score. The scores are so different in each film. To hear you work with the same person would make people who haven't seen them assume there's going to be a similarity. There's not.
They're not.
There's such jarring differences.
But he has an innate ability to understand what the movie needs.
Yeah.
And so with each film we make, I feel like we talk about it less.
Yeah.
And I just will show him the movie. I'll give him a couple ideas that I might have in mind, but he does all his own spotting. Like, we don't do it. We don't go through the movie and say, okay, we need music here, 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 and here.
Yeah.
I just trust him to spot it. And he'll give me music, and sometimes the music needs to move around. Sometimes I decide we don't need music in a certain place. But nonetheless, within 98% of the time, what he gives me right out the gate is what the movie needs to sound like. He writes music that sounds the way the films look and feel.
It's amazing.
And it's an amazing gift when you have a collaborator who can tap into whatever it is you're working on so thoroughly that you don't actually need to talk to them about it. And when you find people like that, you just hold on tight.
I was going
to
say, I think it's why people, you see people work with the same actors or same teams along, and people will start to signify it as nepotism or who you know, whatever. It's like, no, if you find someone who you've got that artistic shorthand with, that you get it, you're on the same page, then that's something that's going to be hard to walk away from, right?
It's
you're not going to want to. Or if you want to go in another direction, it's with them.
It's with them.
You want to go together.
Exactly. You're like, let's grow together as people on this journey.
Yeah.
It's that shorthand is invaluable.
Yeah.
Because when you first get to know someone and you're first working with them, you know, most of what you're doing is convincing them to trust you.
Yeah.
You're like trying to find that trust. And so if that trust is already there, it gives you so much more room to create.
Yeah.
You don't have to like spend time building something. That structure is already there, and you can just keep expanding it.
Yeah, and it, as I said, it really felt on a ghost story. It really felt like a really important one because music's told so much, and it was key to the way I love in the film in general the way time passes in it, because it's really it's fluid. It's not your regular linear passing of time. And I think it's a fascinating thing, because I always remember, I'm a big fan of Prince, and I always remember Prince saying that he doesn't celebrate birthdays, because he's like, if you celebrate birthdays, then that's this mark all the way along that we're counting dates rather than moments.
The chronology is just laid in stone.
Yeah, and a ghost story is a series of moments. It's not a series of dates, and that should be how we approach life and look at life, right? Our existence, marking it by the moments and the exciting highs and lows rather than, oh, it's that date again. I'm now 1 year older.
Here's precisely. Like, my birthday is never the most important day of the year.
Yeah.
Like, I don't remember any of them. They're not that important. I really like to think of time as a dimension that we have not cracked yet.
Yeah.
That it's something that we process in a linear form because we need to as human beings.
Exactly. We understand it the way we need to understand it.
But it's not actually that.
Yeah.
And so in subjecting myself to that linear structure, I still want to play with it as much as I can and push it beyond that form. A ghost story was a chance to do that very actively, very literally, to like actually let the linear form of time break while still following it. Like, the movie starts at one point, ends at another, but within those two confines, I wanted time to become as elastic as I could.
Yeah.
And again, to define it not by the normal benchmarks of progress, but by the emotional peaks and valleys with which we actually do chart our lives. Yeah. I remember falling in love for the first time. I remember my first heartbreak. I don't remember getting my driver's license. You know, things like that.
Yeah.
Things that signify advancement culturally don't matter as much as those signifiers that affect our hearts and our souls.
Completely. So, I mean, I'll wrap things up now by simply asking, and again, this is always the most, this feels like the most fascinating question for you specifically, of what's next, because of this variation of different things, as I stated with the Ben Affleck quote at the start.
It was so helpful that I had already made Old Man the Gun by the time A Ghost Story came out.
Yeah.
Like, we shot the movie.
Oh, really? I didn't even realize.
We shot the movie. Like, it premiered at Sundance.
Because you're still touring Ghost Story as well, right? I'm sure I saw on Instagram
doing
something
that
you were
doing.
Yeah, the Japanese press recently. So.
And it's opening in Japanese or in Japan in November.
Yeah.
So
there's not a lot of subtitling that needs to be done.
It's
so it's an easy transition.
It's perfect. So basically, Ghost Story, we finish Pete's Dragon. We shoot A Ghost Story.
Yeah.
Pete's Dragon opens. Then we finish A Ghost Story. Or we finish post-production on A Ghost Story. Ghost Story premieres at Sundance. We go shoot Old Man the Gun. Then I move into the release of A Ghost Story while posting Old Man the Gun. And now Old Man the Gun's coming out. And we're still talking about A Ghost Story. So it's all blended together. But it was so helpful for me to have made the Old Man the Gun already, because I didn't, as we talked earlier, I didn't expect A Ghost Story to connect the way that it did.
Yeah.
It really landed in a way that I had not anticipated. And I think that if I hadn't already made my next film, I would have been petrified. I wouldn't have known how to follow up A Ghost Story.
I
would have just felt this pressure of expectation. And so it was really helpful that Old Man the Gun was already in the can.
Yeah.
And I could be like, I've already made my next film. It's completely different.
Yeah.
And I can't wait for you all to see it.
I'm not going to ruin anything by this weird film that you might not get. Again, it turns out people did get it. But I've already got this. I can prove myself here.
Exactly.
I can make normal films too.
And so now my next film has not been shot yet. But we're in prep, or in the early stages of prep. And it will, you know, it'll be its own thing. It's something I haven't done before. It's a genre I haven't tapped into, but I think it'll feel very much of a piece with the rest of my movies. And, you know, should it actually come to pass, knocking on wood here, I think people will be very excited about it, but it will also be a surprising left turn, which is always what I want to do. I always want to I don't want to surprise people for the sake of surprising people. I just want to challenge myself with every movie I make and to explore new territory while also doing the things that I like to do as a director.
That's perfect. I can't wait. Well, thank you very much for your time, particularly with your struggling voice.
Yes, I hope it was tolerable to listen to.
Perfect.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Distraction Pieces.
There we go. That was episode 242 of the Distraction Pieces podcast with David Lara. I really enjoyed that conversation, and it really jumped out. I've had some great conversations this year with the directors, and it made me think of when I had Desiree Akhavan on, and she spoke of kind of feeling that the role of a director isn't simply about stamping your imprint on set. It's about creating a set where you can effectively at times not have any imprint, you know, that you can stand back and let the amazing team you've put together and the environment that you've built for this stuff to go on in, you can almost sit back and allow it to play out. If you didn't catch the Desiree Akhavan one, there's a great bit where she talks about a scene in The Education of Cameron Post, The Miseducation of Cameron Post, which came out this year as well. And there's a scene in the back of a car that she talks about, and it's beautiful the way she puts it. And yeah, her role as a director, that she almost felt guilty because she was like, just kind of left everyone to it. She again, it's about setting that scene. I like to think of it as like Miles Davis. Everyone's heard of Miles. And you could argue, well, there's whole bands of amazing musicians on all of his albums, but it was Miles that kind of put that situation together and set that scene to allow this all to play out and be amazing and beautiful. So that's how I think it's something I admire as a directorial trait. And if I ever ended up in that direction, I think that's what I'd be trying to aim towards. But I've no plans to at the moment, in case any of you are wondering and think that that's a subtle hint. I'm not. I'm writing tons of scripts at the moment, and I'm getting better and better at acting and burying myself in that absolute, now lifelong obsession. So that's all the plan. But no immediate plans for direction, but, you know, always on the cards. Anyway, I'm rambling at the end of a podcast again. I rambled at the end of last week's bonus podcast. I did a ramble. Intentionally strange, but I think it's testament to the development of my acting skills that I genuinely got several messages from people asking if I was okay because of this insane ramble. So anyway, I won't repeat it this time. I'll leave you all to it. But next week I've got Boots Riley. The week after that I've got the amazing Russell Kane. And then after that it's Drunkcast time, ladies and gentlemen. We are recording here the weekend after next, I think. And then, yeah, we are all on. So it's going to be Drunkcast being released over Christmas and New Year. Then back with probably my Films of the Year podcast. And then I'm recording some great guests at the moment. There's one guest that has been floated in front of me in theory. It's not confirmed yet. But instantly I was like, yeah, I'd really like that guest on my podcast. That'll be an amazing episode. So please make that happen. So yeah, some good ones to come. I promise you that. But until then, I will see you all next week with Boots Riley. And go and check out The Old Man and the Gun in cinemas a week on Friday. So what's that? December 7th, I think. Around that time. You've got Google in that. Go and give it a look. I will talk to you soon. Ta-ta.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.